When I was in my mid-20s, I had the opportunity to spend some time abroad. The only time I've been able to afford to do something like that, and then only because I was being paid to do it. I had been hired by the Kanjiyama Mime Troupe to bring my particular, some might say peculiar, skill set and perspective to the performance that they were preparing to premiere in Tokyo. It was called Shut Up, Pantomime. One of the things that I remember from that city was some of the amazing juxtapositions in it. I'd be walking on a downtown street surrounded by the immense glass and steel office buildings, and suddenly, in the midst of all that modernity, there'd be a Shinto shrine that had stood in that spot for hundreds of years. It was past and present, intertwined in a way that I had never seen before. I grew up not that far out of New York City, but I have to say that New York almost felt like a quaint country town compared to the hustle and bustle of Tokyo. Yet more than once, I came across a juxtaposition like that of finding the Shinto shrine in and among those capitalist ones. More than once, on the corner of one of those busy, busy sidewalks, I encountered someone like the monk in the image on the cover of your orders of service. Absolutely still, this seemingly anachronistic figure stood in wooden sandals, kimono hiked up and tied at the waist, that straw hat that extended down beyond his nose. These monks would stand there intoning, "Oh," which is Chinese for Dharma, truth, teaching. And in their hands, they held an empty begging bowl. And they stood there as people rushed all around them. Now, as I understand it, the practice of takahashu, begging for their daily needs, is part of at least the Soto Zen Buddhist tradition in Japan and elsewhere. The Buddha told his earliest followers that they should beg as an element of their practice, at least in part, because it provides an opportunity to embody the Dharma of non-attachment. In the Christian scriptures, Jesus is remembered as saying that we shouldn't worry ourselves about what we're going to eat or what we're going to wear. He said that instead we should have faith, that we would trust God and shouldn't get too caught up in these mundane things. I think that this is one way of understanding takahashu. Don't worry about, don't be overly attached to such concerns as what you're going to eat and what you're going to wear and where you're going to live and how you're going to make ends meet. They'll meet or they won't meet. You'll eat or you won't eat. There's no need to obsess over it. There's no need to get caught up, to get caught in these kinds of things. Be alive now, whether you eat tonight or not. Don't miss this moment, whether you're going to sleep under a roof or under the stars. Yet takahashu doesn't just provide a practice for monks, it offers a lesson for everyone else. See, all those people who were scurrying around that silent monk were worrying about what they were going to eat and whether or not what they were wearing was the latest fashion. Much like us, they're rushing from this thing that they think is important to that thing that they think is important. And all of a sudden, they encounter this person who isn't rushing anywhere, who is, in fact, just standing there, just being there. And it's pretty obvious that this still and silent monk doesn't think that the things we think are important are in fact all that important at all. And for just a moment, even if only for the briefest moment, that monk shows us another way of living, another way of prioritizing life, another way, well, another way. It's my understanding that there is yet another dimension to takahatsu, this practice of begging. You know the saying, it's better to give than to receive? Well, by begging, these monks place themselves into the position of receiving, which gives others the opportunity to give. The monks, if you will, make of themselves empty bowls so that the people with whom they come into contact have the opportunity to discover their own fullness. For years, I've been saying that this is the real reason that our congregation, that any congregation, asks its members to make a financial pledge to the extent we're able to. Yes, this church needs money to survive. And yes, those monks need to eat. But in both cases, I'd say that the real purpose of the one who is asking is so that the people who are asked can discover their own capacity to be generous. If the church went out of business, that'd be sad. But if you and I were so caught up in worrying about what we're going to eat and what we're going to wear, or any of the other thousand and one things that our culture conditions us to worry about, then that would be tragic. I think that's a large part of what Mr. Limpkin stands for in Dickens' story. Limpkin is someone who is so worried about not having enough that he hoards far more than he needs. He takes far more than his share because he's afraid, and because he believes that having is more important than just about everything else. He is so convinced that he needs more and more and ever more that he impoverishes those around him in order to enrich himself. But what about young Oliver Twist? Oliver's hungry. He's not asking for more because he thinks he needs to keep up with the Limpkins and then some. He's not asking for more so that he can buy those brand name blazers and that just went on sale or the newest CD player with speakers larger than my car. In fact, more might lead to misunderstanding. Because he's really only asking for enough. But Limpkin is convinced that he needs more, so much so that when someone who really does need more asks for it, he sees it as so scandalous as to think it a capital offense. And that's really what it is to him, an offense. Oliver is a living reminder that his priorities are a little more than askew. By his very presence, Oliver threatens Lipkin's worldview and the comfortable position he has within it. Comfortable, but tenuous. Because he knows, at some level, he knows that what he's doing, that the way he's living, that the way he has prioritized himself is the actual crime. But he doesn't want to have to see that, doesn't want to have to acknowledge that. So he wants to remove Oliver from his sight. He wants Oliver gone. He wants Oliver and all that he represents to die. On those occasions when I saw those monks doing takuhatsu on the Tokyo streets, it was clear that lots of people were taking offense. Those monks threatened their self-understanding, their understanding of themselves as good people who saw the world rightly. But those monks were telling them, showing them, that there is another way. And that is disconcerting. And that is disorienting. And that is discomforting. And that's offensive. And so those monks were jostled and insulted and ignored, much like the people who, unaware of it themselves, are practicing takahatsu on the medians of our city, reminding us that there's another way. Now, also within the Buddhist tradition, there is this figure known as a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is a being who has almost entered nirvana, but who has decided instead to return to the world of delusion, of samsara, in order to help all other beings get there first. And it's said that a bodhisattva can take any number of forms. In fact, that person who seems to be causing you all sorts of trouble might actually be a bodhisattva in disguise. That coworker who's driving you to distraction, that boss who always takes credit for your ideas, that teacher who piles on assignment after assignment after assignment, your kids at times, your parents at times, any of these, all of these might be bodhisattvas providing us opportunities for growth. And so too those monks, and so too young Mr. Twist, and so too those folks who ask for your pledge or attendance at Impact Nehemiah Action, or the guests we welcome here at PACHEM, or the folks who insist over and over again that those of us who identify as white recognize our participation in and even unwitting perpetuation of the systems and structures of white supremacist culture. In each of these situations, in all of these situations, and in so many others, we are given the opportunity to discover our fullness, to discover our capacity for generosity. Because each of us, all of us, have something that we hold on to, afraid that we don't or won't have enough of it. So we hoard that thing, whatever it is, and by doing so, impoverish everyone else. Now, only you know what it is for you, but I'd wager that you do know. If we look deeply and honestly at ourselves, at the way we live, we know. What's in the begging bowl is a mirror in which we see ourselves truly. What's in the begging bowl is an empty space into which we can make an offering of our better selves. What's in that begging bowl is an invitation to join these monks in their stock still standing, to empty ourselves and become a begging bowl, to be a bodhisattva in this world, and to do what we can to ensure that no one goes hungry, whether in body, mind, or spirit. Oh.